You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And on this episode of the Made of Clay Report, we're going to talk with Inbal Schlossberg. Correct on both counts?
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. Inbal, good to have you here this morning.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yes. So, Inbal, the way we work the show is it's a chance to get to know the people in the region whose lives have helped to make it richer, and you are here from Israel.
Yes.
As a trailing spouse with children. I've given that preamble, but who are you?
Okay.
Who are you? And the question is to just get to know so we can start the conversation.
Okay, so my name is Inbal. Inbal in Hebrew means clapper, the inside part of the bell. And I think that's kind of suits who I am. Mm-hmm. I like to be inside of an organization and communities, help to make the sound or the to bring up the voice or create changes from the inside.
Right.
I think this is who I am. Here, if you ask me 2 years ago, I would say that I'm a social worker, a political activist, but I think that here today I'm really mostly a mother,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
of two great and pretty amazing daughters. I have my older one, her name is Noam. She's 4 years old, and Noam in Hebrew is peaceful.
Uh-huh,
peacefulness, uh-huh. And she's a very peaceful daughter. She actually was asleep when I went out today. She was peacefully asleep.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
My younger one is Gili. Gil in Hebrew is joy, and she's a very joyful daughter. And I'm married to a wonderful man. His name is Shai, which is a present in Hebrew. And I think he's my present. It took me a long time to find him, and I really cherish the moment that I did.
Wow.
And beside that, of course, I'm a daughter to a great parents, and who made me who I am. I am a sister to a brother and a sister that just now got new families, and they have their own children in those 2 years that I'm away. And I haven't yet the chance to know them as parents.
Right.
And I think that's the interest of who I am. I grew up. You want me to?
Yeah, no.
Continue.
Yeah.
I'm from Israel. I'm Jewish. I grew up in a kibbutz. Kibbutz is a co-op community, small community.
And kibbutz have kind of trailed off in significance in Israeli society over the last 40 years.
But the stereotype about kibbutz, so if you ask somebody, if he said that he's a kibbutznik or kibbutznik, right, it's like there's a stereotype of a person.
There's a stereotype, yes.
And I think, again, it's something
you don't
that
fit the stereotype.
I do fit. It's like people are mostly naive and think see the good in the world. They like dedicated to hard work,
uh-huh,
and that doesn't matter what is the outcome, because it's
hard work, whether it's physical or emotional or intellectual. They're just hard workers.
And again, it's something that does represent me. They are very, I think, the values of looking about what is going on around you and taking responsibility about what this you're surrounded by.
Right.
And on the other hand, kibbutz people, up until now, they don't know how to cook, because you have a dining room.
Yeah.
You don't know how to do the laundry, because up until now, I don't know how to fold or iron or anything, because there was a laundry room, mm-hmm, that you used to someone else used to do it, and you certainly don't have anything to do with money or how to get used to
it.
Money.
You grew up in a cooperativist or in a almost communist setting, in a communal setting. And I come from rural cooperativist roots in the U.S., mm-hmm, where we had the same kind of gung-ho attitude, but we tended to buy farm equipment together, mm-hmm, and we did the laundry within the home, and and families tended to be big. So, but it's a similar gung-ho attitude and hard work attitude. attitude. And that was what was behind rural cooperativism, which was kind of America's answer to communism or kibbutznik stuff in, mm-hmm. in Israel. It was our own, the Bruderhof, actually, which yeah. is a Christian religious tradition, functions in much the same way as the kibbutz do, when having everybody with a specialized role and eating quarters. It's sweet. Thank you. You have said so very many things about who you are, and in there is also the one about the activist. And this is a time out and a time away, and we'll take that mm-hmm. up more later as part of your passion, but also as stepping away from Israel and coming to the States. You brought some music with you.
Yes.
And will you introduce the first song, because yeah. I'll never get the pronunciation right.
The first song is actually the song that we played in a wedding when we entered the chuppah in the wedding. And it's a band called Bustan Avraham. It's like Abraham Garden. Mm-hmm. And it's a band made of Arab and Jewish people who got together in the 90s, you know, when the utopic period of time that we feel that peace is here.
There was, yeah, it was peace yeah. was on the cusp. It was yes. almost within reach.
Yes, so so they got together and they play music that it's like East and West and Arab and Ashkenaz, all of the and music.
What is the instrument in this here? Because it sounds know. Like a banjo. I mean, it has a similar...
No, I don't think it's a banjo.
It's not but it has that same yeah. quality of that resonance. But no, I know.
Maybe it's a oud, but we can ask...
Yeah, here. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Inbal Schlossberg. Inbal?
Yeah.
Either way. Yeah. What were some of the experiences that you had that you look back on now as having really helped to shape the life that you find meaningful and purposeful?
I think, first of all, the way I grew up, with in a family that is very involved in the community. Of my own family and my uncles and aunts, and like our whole family are a very big part in the community leaders. And my mother, in the time of, I think all over the time when we grew up, but in especially again in the end of the 90s when there was the kibbutzim had like a big suffer from a really crisis, economic crisis,
sure, yeah, just about closed many of them down,
ideological right. crisis and
a rejection of that cooperative way of life, mm-hmm. it seemed by almost all of Israel.
Yes, yeah. So and my parents had like the. They didn't know what to do. They have the opportunity to leave or to stay, or and to stay and change what the way the kibbutz is going on and the way life is in the kibbutz. And my mother decided, they decided to stay, and my mother became the mayor of the kibbutz, or like the. Mm-hmm. The leader of the community, and she did some radical changes that, where I was like a young socialist, I just started in our youth movement and like a very socialist youth movement, and I was very upset of what she's doing, but
right, but your mom was not keeping the faith.
No, she was you know. Putting, it's just they had to rescue, you know, to what was, you know, the kibbutz was in a really bad shape financially,
sure,
and they have to raise that, so everybody had to, you know, walk through that, and everybody got hurt in some way, but she made this community, and now it's like a really really big and successful community that people are not as bond to each other or depend on each other, but they still have a lot of solidarity between mm-hmm. each other, and they still have a lot in common, and a lot of new commitments has become after a few years of, you know, of the change, and I think after that she did it in other places, and but the way that the taking responsibility about my reality, my surrounding reality, mm-hmm. is something that I got at home and I learned at home. And I think it's something that goes with me and everywhere I go.
And I'm also hearing that you learned that you could have a profound conflict mm-hmm. with a parent and maybe not win the conflict, and it would still work out.
Yeah, it can still work out. And I, of course, it took me a few years to understand that. But even then, I remember that I trust her on what she's doing. And I learned from it a lot. And I used to advocate for her in you know, in the youth movement, of explaining what she's doing in the kibbutz and fighting with her at home, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but I think we've gone over that, and we learned. And actually, a few years later, I was in a group that innovate like an urban community in Be'er Sheva, where I studied, mm-hmm. and the way we shaped it, it's actually the same as the new kibbutz are now. Like there's some kind of solidarity, commitment to each other, but everybody has his own salary. Everybody, you know, it's like the dependent and independent of each other. And I think it was based on all the things that she taught me in this period of time.
And it sounds like what it's allowing people to identify some boundaries mm-hmm. in their lives, because in the earlier kibbutz movement everything was mushed together and the potential for conflict and the potential for collapse is really intense there, and mm-hmm. if there's no conflict there's often collapse, and if there's too much conflict there's the whole thing blows up.
Yes, I think in every community you have mm-hmm. this tension and trying to understand what are the borders of that, or how much individual and how much collective, and it's something that I always, you know, it's something that keep me occupied in my mind to think what is the right, now we think where we want to live and what is the way we want to live in. So I think it's something that I take with me.
What advice would you give?
I can tell about. I can continue with that. Whatever you want.
No, what I wanted to say was, what advice would you give adult children, young adult children, about dealing with their parents, or parents about dealing with their young adult children when they are changing the rules of their lives? How was it that what worked for you to engage your mother and yourself, and what worked for her?
I think,
and what didn't?
I think the base is always trust. You know, I know she is my mother, and I trust her that she won't, that what she's doing is even if I want, you know, if I have like all kind of ideology thoughts, or but she to understand that, and she's shaping her life and mm-hmm. her, and others' life, but she's not, but and I can do whatever, and I can choose to be there or not to be there, but this is the her place, mm-hmm. and I think this is another thing, you know, it's not that she's doing it only for me, she's doing it for herself, and I respect it for herself, and I think that helped me to respect it afterwards, to do right. to do it, you know, to be able to accept it and to understand it later.
Right, right. So you had a bigger picture.
Yeah.
The whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And that, so what was it about communication in your family that allowed, because a lot of, particularly in America, in the U.S., that there's not that kind of open conversation, wide communication, so you really know what's going on. You know, there are lots of kids who have no idea what their parents' financial situation really is, or what their reality is. How is that different?
I think first of all, it's a cultural difference, because mm-hmm. we talk about, especially finance. It's something that is very open mm-hmm. in our culture, and I think they treat us like grown-ups. You know, we had a conversation of people who have thoughts and thinking and doubts about what other and respect other each other doubts and thoughts, and I think this,
and they're expressible. You can express your
doubts. You can express your doubts, right. And it's in, and you'll get accepted no matter what is the doubt that you bring in. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a value that I got from them. Beside that, I can tell that I was when you ask the question about you know, events that shaped or who I am now or experience, or I can tell about again in the 90s about Rabin's murder in Prime Minister Rabin in 1995, and I think that this experience of I was just started to be a guide of young kids in fifth grade, and we went. Not with them, but we went to this demonstration and this peace party in Saturday night in Tel Aviv, and Rabin was on the stage, and then and it was like an euphoria and peace is coming, and we mm-hmm. were like very, very optimistic, and then when we walked to the buses, we suddenly saw Rabin's car, you know, passing through us, you know, almost hitting one of us, but because he was driving really, really fast, and it was driving really, really fast, and then we were laughing, you know, wow, he's running from the traffic, and then we arrived to the buses, and then we started hearing that he was shot, and then started hearing that, you know, what happened, and that, you know, what will be with the peace, and what will be now, and it was a very traumatic experience. Yeah. But in the morning after, we had to come and speak to the children about it, and having to talk and explain this, you know, and you have to bring them hope, you have to bring them talk about future, you cannot be just in the position of that terrible thing that just happened.
You can't just be in anger mode.
No, and just I think modify the way I had to be strong for them, and I had to be I have to find the places of hope in myself, so I can be able to pass it to them. And I think this experience really shaped, like in the next few years, like for me to be in this role is something that helped me.
Right. What did you, when you had to explain Yitzhak Rabin's assassination to these fifth graders the morning after, what did you do?
We took them and asked them. I don't remember, you know, the details, but I can tell you. But yeah. I think that hearing from them what are they feeling and having place to express their feelings, and then finding and talking about that the man might be dead, or he's not here, but right. his ideas or ideology is still here, and this is mm-hmm. the thing that we need to continue on fighting for, and that change is something that takes time and that takes it has its own it takes things with it on the way, and that we have to continue with a struggle even stronger. And I think I don't remember exactly if this is what it, but this is about the spirit of it.
The energy of loss and the anger of loss, also the hope that made the pain real.
Yes, and I think I it helped me, and I think in a more wide way, I think it made me understand, or in the next years, that one of my mission is to be a person that, you know, that's it helped me to be in a role, you know, of a position to help others, or to find hope and optimism to others, and it also felt that something that I should continue on doing, and. I can continue on other things.
Continue, because let's cut to a musical selection. Okay. What should we play next?
I think the Yoman Masa, you see? It's the one.
Yes. And do you want to say something before we play?
Yes, it's a song. It's an Israeli song. It's two singers, very famous singers. One is young and one is just passed away the last a year and a half ago. Aviv Geffen and Arik Einstein. And it's the song about a journey. It's our life journey somehow. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say a sentence from the song. It's like, if somebody is coming, don't turn around, because it can always be the one that will open up your heart or will light out your heart and will take the pain away. And another, I think, a strong sentence is the touch of the softness is stronger than the heat.
Uh-huh.
We are all made of dust of love, and we look up and we take praise, but in the meantime we don't remember that the meaning of the life is to ask the question but also to answer them. Okay. It's a mix of but we need to listen to this
song. And this is also here we go.
אין ספור שבילים ויציאה, רושם בתוך יומן מסע, להתערבב ולא להיבלע, רושם בתוך יומן מסע, והיה מישהו בא, אל תסתובב, כי זה תמיד יכול להיות, זה שידליק לך את הלב, יפרוק את הכאב בשלווה. רושם בתוך יומן מסע, כולנו עשויים אבק של אהבה, רושם בתוך יומן מסע, מביטים למעלה ונושאים תפילות, שבינתיים שוכחים שהמשמעות לחיות היא לשאול את השאלות ולענות.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Inbal Schlossberg. Inbal, you've had experience working at the grassroots in the labor movement in Israel, and so tell us about that, and we'll move into more things that tie us back to Ithaca pretty
okay.
soon.
Okay. So I think a lot of what shaped, again, the things that I'm doing now that we are... that can contribute to what is going on now in the States is learning from success or from the experience of success. I was as a young social worker. I was involved in establishing a movement of social worker against the privatization of social services. And we've been, I think, in this struggle for 10 years, and just now we've been succeed to achieve a really, really important goal that we had. And I think that we have this goal like in 2007 or 2006, that we want to equalize the wages and the condition of the work social workers and in the private sector to the public sector, not the privatized sector,
right?
The services that have been privatized in Israel. And we did it by joining the union, mm-hmm. and renovating the union from the inside, and then achieving, trying to make the union much more community organized and mm-hmm. grassroots based. And we worked all over Israel for many years to bring more people. In the beginning, we started from the outside, and then we understand we have to do things from the inside. And the way to do it is to get inside and to get involved inside the system that already exists. This is right. why I believe. And
both strategies yeah. work, but they work in different ways, and they have different
outcomes. I think you should do them both.
Yeah, yeah.
And you should, if you manage to do them both simultaneously, then this tension is something that can really be helpful. And we actually, this last 3 weeks ago, after, I don't tell all of this because it will take 5 days, but there's now a new rule in Israel that equalizes the benefits and the salary of the social worker that work in the public sector and the one who are privatized when sponsored by the government, which is mm-hmm. most of the services.
Contract workers, yeah.
Yeah, all the contract, and they're supposed to get the same salary. So in this way, there's no, you don't need to privatize because you will have to pay them the same. So it brings up the responsibility back to the government, and I hope it will be helpful to other occupation, and mm-hmm. and hopefully, and I think this is what the struggle was all about, is that the social worker could give a better work and to help people change their life and not be concerned about their own security,
right.
or job security that they were lack of in the last few years. And of course it has to be, you know, we haven't seen it
in action yet, but
it's really, really new. But for me, learning that if I have a mission and a goal and it's very precise and I know mm-hmm. exactly what I want to achieve, and it won't take 1 year, it won't take 5 years. It's a long, long distance running. But if you really, really believe in something and you want to get somewhere, and so it's something that can be done, and a grassroots movement is the way to do it. This is why I really believe, and I feel that I've experienced in all kinds of ways, and this is, and it's something that I'm taking with me.
Right, Right, and in a certain way, the analog in the States is the move to make $15 an hour the minimum wage for everybody. I mean, when I was started working at about, I started working illegally at the age of 11, but at the minimum wage at that point was, in today's dollars, about $15 an hour. So I, as an 11-year-old, I made a difference in my family's life.
Wow.
And that was, you know, something that's been huge to me, and I worked 20 to 30 hours a week during the school year and 30 to 60 hours a week during the summers, and that's just the way it was. But, you know, you can't do that when the minimum wage is $7.50 or $8 or whatever,
wow,
depending upon where you are in the United States. Yeah.
Yes.
So, yeah. What have you learned about yourself? What have you learned about engaging others that you didn't realize you'd have to learn to be an effective advocate and to be, you know, to continue to be whole? Yeah,
I think that being part of a group is something that at least for me is something that you need so you can do any change that you want to do or to advocate for, and you need to be. To really feel the I don't know if it's the anger or the ambition,
the passion yeah,
to change, or to really feel like, for me, like social justice is something that can make me stand and do something. Mm-hmm. I can't stand the not doing anything. It's something that is more difficult to me than doing.
Right, and I think this is an interesting, that we're struggling for the right word here, because I don't know about Hebrew, but in English, many of the words that are used these days are based in indignation rather than based in, this is the good that we cannot miss.
Mm-hmm.
And it really needs to be both, because if it's in indignation, it's anger.
Yes.
Which is what you were leaning towards initially. But it's not just about anger, it's about the good that we don't dare miss.
Mm-hmm. That it has to be done.
Yeah, it has to be done, because it would just be foolish not to.
Yes. So I feel that this is, and I, the being, I don't know the word in English, but to do with something to understand that it's a long run.
Mm-hmm.
Things take change. We know when you're a student, you go in all those organizations, you want to make change in the society that you live in, you want to do things, and then you graduate and you go on to your job or your family or career. Right. When those things take time, they don't finish in 2 or 3 years. Nothing can change, I believe, in 2 or 3 years.
And there's a saying that anything worth doing is probably going to take longer than your lifetime.
Yes.
You know, and that's what I hear you,
mm-hmm,
you saying. And then it becomes a matter of faith, which is not pie in the eye, mm-hmm, I'm pie in the sky, positive wishful thinking. It's a matter of living your hope.
Yes.
In very practical small steps. How have you learned to do that? How have you learned to kind of,
I think,
hold that forward momentum, knowing that these are very small steps?
I think that trying to learn from success, that I feel that the way I grew up, mm-hmm, in is to acknowledge the thing that I succeed to do, or I'm good at,
right,
or I did good, and to learn from them, you know, the smallest achievement, to have a driving license, mm-hmm, to change. I can tell you all thousands of small examples of small things that I changed in my life or in the life of others that made, I know that I did it, and it made me feel good and power that I can,
right,
continue on doing that.
What you're hiding, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what you're dancing with is kind of this in organizational behavior, which is one of my,
mm-hmm,
one of my interests and backgrounds. People experience the greatest satisfaction from their successes, mm-hmm, but they learn the most from their failures.
I'm not sure.
And in terms of when they can figure out that something went wrong and they can figure out how to make it right, you know, that then once they make it right, then they experience the satisfaction of success.
And also I feel like was born, you know, I was lucky. It's not me as a person. I was lucky to be born to you know, to the right color, to the right, to the people with the power. I don't know. And I feel like this is my responsibility, my obligation, to share this power with the people who don't, who weren't lucky to were born with, and to help them to gain this power. You know, to, if I have education that people cannot afford, so I should teach the people I'm working with the thing that I learned, the social worker techniques. So all kind, I feel like this is again one of the things that I really believe and I practice, and again, when you have faith and you have a goal and you have hope, so I don't know how you get hope, but I feel like if it's an optimism perspective, is seeing the good. And
well, with a stance of hope, I'm constantly curious and looking about what might work, even though I don't necessarily know where I'm going to find it. Mm-hmm. With despair, I tend to shut down and I don't look as closely, mm-hmm. so I'm not effective. So the hope is not because I know concretely where I'll end mm-hmm. up. And so that kind of makes hope a more neutral tool mm-hmm. that we use. I want to go back to one thing that you said. There was a way in which when you have this power that comes both by mm-hmm. by color and class and educational status, that can be framed as a way of sharing one's privilege, but that's not the way you really mean it at all.
No.
And what it is it's you don't own anything you have. Mm-hmm. It's only valuable in as much as other people have access to mm-hmm. it. And that is the way in which we attack privilege without attacking the person who bears some of the fruit of it, if you mm-hmm. know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have a very hard time in this country articulating that subtle difference.
I worked when I just became a social worker. I worked for 5 years with the Bedouin community in mm-hmm. Israel, which is the I think the poorest and exiled minority in Israel and in the south of the country. And I worked with people who were like suffer from so many layers of depression. Especially women who are like they are Arab, they are poor, they are like Arab minority, not just
they are minority within the community.
Right. They are poor.
They're almost untouchable in that sense. Yeah.
They are black, and again in this specific community, it has another meaning, and they are like the third women because there's the polygamic families, and you have to help, you know, to meet those people in their houses, in their, it's not really a house, it's like something made out of half a tent and half something else, and
it's a structure that has come about from a group that were nomadic.
Yes, and you try to, and I can honestly say that it's part of it was very, very difficult. I wanted to walk there because I wanted to feel the you know what are the hardest or what do people deal with in the real life? Mm. Who are the community we should, if I want to be, you know, the minister of welfare someday or to do something like big, I have to know the people suffer and to help a one-on-one person.
You have to know their lives as well as you know your own almost.
Yes. And this experience, it wasn't easy. But I think I learned a lot, and for me personally, I felt that the helping one-on-one is something that I can do, and I did. But my job is much more. It's more organizing, and mm-hmm. it's more like community service, and to help them increase their innovation. There was a woman who wanted to teach. She taught her mother-in-law and other how to write in mm-hmm. Arabic. So I helped her, you know, get finance for this class. There was a group of people who wanted to they did like a summer camp for their younger, so to their students, so to give them structure and salary and bring them all kinds of activities that they can do with the kids, and to help in what they are already doing and to increase that and to and I felt that this is the way I can mm-hmm. can contribute. And after a few years, I moved to work really the other side of the South,
right?
Metaphorically and also
and physically.
Yeah, yeah. On the border next to Gaza, I worked in a regional council called Shaar HaNegev. I wanted to work there because there was a community. As a community organizer, and I wanted to do more than that. And this is the only place who can afford like a full time community organizer.
Right.
And I worked with kibbutzim again or villages on the border with Gaza on Gaza, and my job was to help the emergency civilian teams. Mm-hmm. I work in a resilience center, and we had like the volunteering teams in those villages that they are in charge whenever something happened, when a missile is falling, when bombs, that there was all kinds of terror attacks, mm-hmm. and their job is to organize the community and to help people cope in the situation, and my job was to help them, to recruit them and to organize them and to help them.
So they're the first responders to the attacks, which could be involving medical care or just the mm. trauma of the processing it, and then, mm-hmm. and you are helping to recruit and train and organize those first responders.
Yes. And on the summer of 2014, there was a war in Israel, and I was pregnant with my second daughter, and I was going between the bombs, you know, between village to village and to the regional council, and trying to understand how you know, it was a war. I have all kinds of experience. I don't know if I should share them now, but yeah. You know, a lot of. One day I went back home to Be'er Sheva after a long day. I'm barefoot because of the heat and because of the pregnancy, and right. I'm driving home and I'm talking to my husband. He was with my older daughter in the north, and then he told me there's a siren here also. Somehow they got a missile up to the north, and my daughter is crying I hear her, and they have in where his parents live. They don't have like a bomb shelter or something. Shelter. So they just stand in the hallway, and I hear that. And in the meantime that this is happening, I hear a siren from outside of the car, like where I'm standing. I'm driving, so I have to pull up the car, and I went. I was barefoot, running on the grass. It's 10 p.m. in the night. Mm-hmm. I'm in my 8 month of pregnancy, running up to some hill in the entrance to Be'er Sheva, and then I see the missile above me and like clashing to the Kippat Berzel missile. It's like Patriot. It's a missile of
the counterattack.
Yeah, the so counterattack, and it blew up in the air. And then I understand that my phone is not with me, and my husband is on the line down where the car is. So I'm running down back to the car to get my phone, and as I get to the car, there's another alarm. So I take the phone with me, and I'm running back up to the it happened like 3 times, and eventually, everything was okay. I was fine. He was fine. But a lot of people weren't fine in this moment and in this after these 2 months in both sides of the border.
Right.
I have a connection with. You know, people from with the Bedouin village where I live, that they, you know, they have families in Gaza.
Right.
And once I was talking to one of them, like I was in my side and she was in the other side, and she was calling me to ask me to help her to get outside. You know, there was an operation. I hear the mm-hmm. bombs in her side. I hear the bombs on my side. And I understand that, you know, it's the same bombs. We are all suffering from the same... reality,
madness,
reality when kids are being killed. And after this summer was established a movement called Women Wage Peace, which I'm a member of. And this movement is talking about, it has one goal of having the government to get to an agreement, a mutual agreement, both sides agree, and a long-term solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And this is the song that I've chose to put, and the song is a song that was in the march. They did a march of hope. We talked about hope and what does it give. Mm-hmm. On in the last October, and on this march, in the last day, it was from all over Israel, and in the last day they did like a march that go to the they went inside Qasr al-Yahud. It's an area that it's in the occupied territories, but that Palestinians can also come. And they didn't know, like they came like three or 4,000 Israelis came over there, mm-hmm. Jewish and Arabs and mm-hmm. left and right wing, right. They came there, and suddenly arrived also the Palestinians from the West Bank, yeah. Like 1,000 Palestinians, women, marched with them. And it was a really, really big demonstration of hope and a very, very, after that in the evening, there was another demonstration in Jerusalem of 20,000 people over Israel who came to this
of all different event, backgrounds
of all different backgrounds, and this is the song that we will hear. It's the prayer of the mothers, that talks about the need for peace and the leadership of the mothers to bring it.
Okay, let's play it.
רכישת רוח ים מנשבת מאי שם וכביסה מתנפנפת לצילי החומה בין אל-ארד וסמע נסיק תיר באיש וסמע ما تخافوا تحلموا بالسلام والأمان ما تعيب سوخ وما تبخت وشعبتي ميقالوتي يبتخو شعب אל הטוב האמיתי
Palestine. Thank you. Peace. Shalom. From the Lord.
was the prayers of the mothers. The prayers of the mothers for peace. Inbal, what have you learned as an organizer, social worker, women as with Women Wage Peace, what have you learned that has had to deepen or change or to kind of to prepare you for a task that may not be quite what you thought it was 30 years ago, but you've come to know now?
In some way, I feel that getting to know the people who are similar but different than you, like within the Jewish people,
uh-huh,
or the Israeli community, can be harder than to getting along with the other.
It may be easier to relate to Palestinian women than to some of the Jewish women in Israel.
I don't know if to relate, I can relate, but I mean to really to be able to convince or to be able to I can understand a lot of what my understanding for the other, you know, for the one that is in distance for me, it's much harder than to understand the people who are more similar and close to me and don't think the same
and
as
who politically disagree with you about the nature of peace, mm-hmm, or how to pursue it.
And I feel like this is the job that has to be done. This is the wall that have to be
divide is the divide within our house,
yes,
more than the divide across our houses.
I feel in a way that if we can understand each other and bring up a solution together and agree with each other, then mm-hmm, to meet the other will be a much easier process, and this is, I feel like it's a very important message. I feel like a lot of what Women Wage Peace in Israel is doing now is going to communities that are not classically, you know, left wing movements or and to places that have suffered from like social problems more than the security problems, and they are and to engage them to this movement, mm-hmm, and I feel like the same in the States in some ways to get to know the people that you disagree with, but you are also afraid of because they have something that reminds you of parts of you that you don't like,
right,
or that are.
And the stereotype is that they may value security more than peace,
yeah,
and you may stereotype them as violent,
yes,
or as mm-hmm, oppressive when you don't want to be that. But if you don't know them, you don't know, and they may stereotype you as naive,
yes,
and willing to take abuse that you shouldn't take,
mm-hmm,
and that I think. Within Christianity, within here, we have the same problems, mm-hmm, here. The hardest divides are within those who are our own, but we see them as other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I get it. I get it. Inbal,
yes.
What I'd like to close the show with is, what do you do? What are some of the things you do to take care of yourself emotionally, physically, intellectually? You work in high trauma, high stress space. What do you do to care for yourself?
I come to Ithaca.
You get out of it. You get some distance on it for a while.
I think I wish to everybody to have his own Ithaca,
right,
in
right,
his life.
Right.
But to get away for a minute or for a month or for a year, and mm-hmm, and to come back with energy, to spend time with family, really spending time with family and enjoying it. And I love to travel and to be in the nature. It's mm-hmm, something that, and here it's, you just go outside your house and you're in the nature, and water is the thing that most relaxes me. So here we have
abundance of water.
Yeah, here. And yeah. I feel like it's in Israel it will be the sea that I will go to, and so I feel like, you know, taking a time off for myself, for being with the people I care, my friends, my family is this is the way I mm-hmm, I get my energy.
Cool. Inbal, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you.
You wanted to close with a song, Kay's Choice, My Favorite Adventure.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything about
it? Yeah, it's a song I know from my youth, from my army serving with my friends. And I think it talks about a really a great moment that we cherish the moment that we are in now, or that is a good moment. It's if we ever feel someday we might lose this, come back here to this moment that we last, when time can go so fast and everything exactly where it sits, its very best.
And we can return there, almost like a meditative space where you can go back and you can get yourself right again.
Yes.
Powerful. Thank you, Inbam.
Thank you.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and that concludes the Made of Clay report.